Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 6. Coming up on this show, we've got the posture key to other realities, the secret elephants of Neisner, and when your dead grandpa gets trapped in a box of Japanese chocolates. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
To be fair, it's bean confectionery, but still, that is actually what happens. This poor fellow gets trapped inside it, yes.
That stuff's gross.
You're not a fan?
No, I remember the first time I got offered one of those Japanese bean candies and I thought, oh, this looks like a nice chocolate mousse treat.
They look beautiful.
And they taste like cardboard.
Yeah. Well, not so much cardboard, but yes, they do have an unusual texture to them. But no, I ended up finding this story at a book called Where the Spirits Ride the Wind, Trance Journeys and Other Ecstatic Experiences. And I was pleasantly surprised by this book. This is just, it's funny. I was thinking about it today when we do research for the show. And normally when I'm researching for a show, I'm like a semi-truck, like bashing through a highway. I was going to slam through it, get what I can get. It's very jarring.
Yeah, a bunch of books end up in the bin. Yeah, some get burnt.
Like, this was like taking a very calm, easy ride through the countryside today with birds chirping and the sun shining. It's a really lovely book full of some incredible experiences of people that have accessed the trance realm or alternative realms.
What's the trance realm?
So the trance realm essentially is that the woman that wrote this book, Felicitas Goodman, she found that throughout the world, when people spoke in tongues, they actually had this same signature, a pattern. There was like this audio pattern inside every single person that spoke in tongues.
What, a pattern in terms of cadence or rhythm?
Cadence, rhythm, everything. Like there's this pattern that she could actually pick up. And she went around the world and she found it didn't matter what language you were speaking in tongues in or if like what your background was. It had this same very pattern. So she dived into this to see if she could pull out something and she ended up going into this world of trance. This world of trance starts connecting people with alternative realities, different realms, and it just ends up being an incredible saga connected to old figurines and statuettes.
What?
And French cave paintings.
This is cool.
It's cool. It's
and you were talking about weird postures involved today as well.
Well, that's what it's about. So after, I don't want to explain too much in this section, I'll explain it all in plus, but ultimately what she found is that there was something missing in her research. And this is a very much because she's an anthropologist and there was something that was missing though. She worked out that it was about postures. And so she went and replicated the postures that you find on cave paintings, on old figurines. And when I'm talking about very, very, you know, old, you know, ancient figurines and doing this while going into a trance, it elicits a certain doorway. It puts you into a certain realm and causes you to interact with certain entities that's repeatable over and over again. And what's so cool about this is that she's worked with universities, she's worked within academic settings,
really?
Fields. It's just amazing. And she's just developed.
When did this come out?
This was 1990 that this was published. So, and I feel like in a way today, this came to me as kind of an epiphany because for whatever reason, I had no idea what you were going to be doing on the show. And I was like, oh, I should just look up something on the site about demonic possession because I was looking for a story about demonic possession. And it led me to this book because the reason I last spoke about Goodman was when I was covering that story of the guy in California that got possessed, like seemingly was possessed by a demon and his facial features actually physically changed.
Yeah.
Well, she's done a lot of research into demonic possession as well. And that's how I found it. That's how I got into this book. And this thing is just mind-blowing.
Well, the funny thing about this week is you started reading the Soviet Sasquatch book, which both accidentally ordered.
Yes.
And it was a little bit dry, wasn't it?
It was
so,
you had to switch gears. Yeah, it was so dry. And in the light of, you know, just repeatable stories of, you know, see a guy with dark hair and it was like, yeah, I can't do that.
Well, I did the same thing, but in reverse. I started going into Alan Sanderson's upcoming book. I got an advance copy. It's Psychiatry and Spirit World: True Stories on the Survival of Consciousness After Death. It's not out until October. But the reason I wanted to grab this is because Edith Fiore wrote the foreword. And Edith Fiore, you may remember, we've done a few shows on her work.
She's great.
She's written a bunch of books on the idea of spirit possession in her patients. And she's also written a book on alien abductions and past lives as well. But she seemed to figure out a way to help people and also set up a kind of dialogue with entities that seem to be responsible for a lot of the kind of manic episodes in some of her patients.
Well, it was like a spirit release, wasn't it? Even though she didn't herself directly believe that she was interacting with other entities, she was capable of removing them by making out that they were real.
That's right. So Sanderson, he first heard of her work from a colleague in London who was also doing psychiatry, but started to treat people with this spirit release technique. And he was bamboozled by it. He'd never heard anything like it. He thought, what is this? Is so unconventional. What do you mean you're releasing spirits from people?
And it's so foreign to anyone in that possession, well, in that profession.
Well, one of the books he was lent by this guy was Edith Fiore's. And he actually thought, well, I'll just try it. So he had this psychotic patient. His name was Peter or something. And he just was beyond help. The guy was violent. He was psychotic. They tried everything, you know, drugs, years of therapy. And one day Alan thought, you know what? I'm just going to try this, the whole spirit release thing, and see what happens.
Like so, a last resort?
Well, he puts him in a hypnotic state because he eventually learned how to do hypnosis as well as part of this. But part of the technique was getting the patient to imagine that they're looking into a mirror. So you put them in a deep hypnotic state, tell them to look into a mirror and then see if there's any dark spots in the mirror. And then eventually ask them if those dark spots could talk, what would they say? And that's when, in some instances, entirely different personalities would come through.
Really?
And all he would do is simply get the patient to say, ask them to leave. And it wouldn't work every time, but he had instances, and especially with this guy who was beyond help for years, it completely fixed him. Like he didn't need any therapy. It's unbelievable. And his story's interesting because eventually the NHS, the public health provider in the UK, got wind of what he was doing and basically booted him out.
Are you kidding me?
Said, you're not allowed to practice this on NHS patients. You can't do this on NHS property.
But it's working.
They didn't care. They didn't care that it was working. Yeah. So he ended up setting up his own non-profit organization to help practitioners of this technique so that they could get support and learn techniques off each other. I might actually go into it because I had some other stuff today. Like I was saying, we did a reverse thing where you were doing Bigfoot and went into
basically possession stuff. Experiences. And, yeah,
I ended up going into, which I still want to talk about, this book called Beyond the Secret Elephants by Gareth Patterson. And I saw this post on Twitter today by a user named Actual Aurox, and he was linking to this guy's book saying, you got to check this out. It's a really interesting story. Gareth Patterson was he's still a wildlife expert and a conservationist. And he released this widely acclaimed book back in 2009 called The Secret Elephants. And it detailed his work in this forest right in the south of South Africa, like right on the coastline. It's called the Knysna Forest. And it's sort of this tropical, subtropical forest. And in the past, there had been elephants there. And not like forest elephants, like you'd get in Thailand or something, not jungle elephants, actual savanna elephants that just lived in this forest.
What, do they somehow migrate there and there's a population of them?
Yeah, there was thousands of them there throughout history. But unfortunately, you know, from the early 90s onwards, it was actually believed that all the elephants, they were functionally extinct. So the widely held understanding from the experts there and, you know, the wildlife experts who lived in the region was that there was one matriarch left, this one lonely elephant.
Aww.
It reminded me of the story of that lonely-ass whale that was...
Who's dead now, by the way.
Lost from its pod. I can't remember its story. It was like, it was too annoying, and then the other whales didn't want to talk to it.
Wasn't an albino as well?
Yeah, it was just this weird munted whale, and none of the other whales wanted to talk to it, and scientists picked up its calls, and it was just like the loneliest animal. It's called the loneliest animal in the world because it's like in the middle of the ocean with no friends. This lonely matriarch elephant reminded me of that. And Gareth Patterson, he had just finished doing this conservation work, exposing the canned lion practice in Africa, which is basically where they take lion cubs or they capture lions. And then they put them in this huge enclosure, like a huge property that's fenced. And then foreigners come in and they shoot them. It's like a hunting ground for these
lions. Why would they do that?
Because it's like, oh, look, I shot a lion. You get a photo.
What an asshole thing to do.
You get a trophy. He thought the whole thing was abhorrent. So he went on to basically raise awareness of what was going on and try and get some of them shut down. And he managed to rescue quite a lot of lions. And it was after this, it was about 1999. And he had heard about this forest area, this Knysna Forest, and he wanted to go and stay for a holiday. So he went with his girlfriend, and they were staying at this beautiful little, you know, village near the edge of the forest. And he started this eventually a couple of years later, once he heard about this lone matriarch, he started a study on this lone elephant in this forest. And he said, my research, it was a combination of covering thousands of kilometers on foot, as well as undertaking two DNA censuses in conjunction with one of the world's leading geneticists, Dr. Laurie Eggert, proved that a tiny but viable Neisser elephant population actually existed. So there was more than one. He ended up finding dozens of these elephants, which people thought extinct. And up until 2019, the local wildlife authorities were saying, no, there's only one elephant in this forest. There's no population. And he just went and proved them wrong, that there was this population that was still there. And that's why his first book was called The Secret Elephants, because they really were secret. There was this population hidden from our modern world for decades and decades. So a lot of this book is about Patterson's work on tracking down these elephants, studying them. And they're quite mysterious. Like you would think finding an elephant would be pretty easy because they're big. But this park area is thousands and thousands of kilometers. And they're very stealthy. And the way that the underbrush works is there's no tracks because of, you know, it's just like crushed leaves and it's hard ground. And it's not like it's all muddy and you can track elephants.
Isn't it amazing though when you think about it? I mean, an elephant, like a massive African elephant, and you couldn't find them, like we couldn't see them. It says a lot about cryptozoology, doesn't it?
That's why I was interested in this, because it really does reveal that large animals can remain undetected from our modern society.
Like 8 feet tall animals?
For a long period of time. Well, he was in this region. This is before he did this study. It was in 1999, and he was staying at this hotel on the outskirts of the forest with his girlfriend, Francia. And he came down for breakfast one morning, and the hotel manager, who they'd got to know the night before, who knew that he had worked with wildlife and knew his history with lions, kind of pulled him aside and said, hey, Gareth, you know, you and Francie, you should move down to this beautiful place and investigate what's really going on with these elephants. And he went on to explain to them, look, you know, the authority claims that there's just this one elephant, but none of the locals believe it. We know that there's more elephants out in that forest, out in that jungle. But he also said, look, if you do come down here, you must be aware that there's a greater mystery out there than these hidden elephants. And he's intrigued and he's like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And this hotel manager says, look, what I'm about to tell you, I wouldn't have believed it myself had I not heard it directly from the eyewitnesses. So recently he explains he had this party of wealthy, well-traveled German guests staying at his hotel. This is a few weeks earlier. Very nice group of people, you know, chatty, jovial, very cheerful. And he said, like you and your girlfriend, one morning they planned to drive into the forest and, they asked for directions to this specific nice spot to go to. And he said, I gave them directions. But he said, the next time I saw my German guests, it was later that afternoon at the hotel bar. And it was like they were all sick or something. Like they were clearly subdued and strangely quiet, he said. And he thought something was wrong. He sensed something was wrong. So he goes over there and he asks them, you know, is everything okay? Was your stay going okay? Did you have a good time in the forest? And Gareth is like, well, what did they say? And he says, it's what they saw in the forest that freaked them out.
What did they see?
He says it was beings far more mysterious than these hidden elephants. He said, the Germans told me that as they were driving towards the Dipwale area, they saw three upright figures on the side of the road. At first they thought they were people, but as they got closer, they realized that they were three bipedal ape-like animals, which quickly crossed the road and vanished into the forest. They were russet colored, and the Germans said they were completely covered in hair. So Gareth hears this and he's like, okay, baboons.
Mm.
And the hotel manager says, well, yeah, that's what I said to them. And they got furious with me for suggesting this. He says these were educated, well-traveled people. They certainly knew what baboons were. And then he's like, I realized that my guests were clearly in shock because of what they had seen. Like you could see it on their faces. They were quiet. They were just like something had seriously upset them. They were so disturbed, he said, they left the very next day. They were booked for a week in his hotel. They just left. No word, just gone the next day, checked out. So a couple of years later, Gareth begins his study on the elephant population. And I'm too far into this story now to go back to the spirit possession stuff. If I've got time, I'll mention some more of that at the end of this show. But he starts doing this elephant population study and he ends up getting a house that's right on the edge of the forest. It's like plantations around there, but it's right on the edge. He's like a stone's throw from the edge of the central forest. And his routine each day would be to drive out into the elephant's range and basically walk for half a day trying to find signs of the elephants, because seeing them really was like trying to find Bigfoot.
Yeah.
It's virtually impossible to find them. It's such a large area. They don't go anywhere. If they smell you, they'll just go in the other direction. So he's looking for droppings, footprints, feeding signs. And he said in that first few years of the study, he covered 22,000 kilometers on foot.
22,000?
22,000 kilometers.
And still didn't find anything.
That's like walking halfway around the equator. And yeah, he came across pretty early on. He did come across evidence. So he found clear evidence. He said that there was more than one elephant. He found footprints, droppings of various sizes. It clearly indicated different individuals, not this silly story that it was just one matriarch. And so he could measure the size of the footprints and then determine their age. And he could measure the circumference of the dung balls, for example, and then to figure out the age and the gender and all that sort of stuff. So early evidence showed, yeah, there was a population of young adults. And it was during those early months of this elephant study, he didn't even think about what that hotel manager had told him about these mysterious beings that the German tourists had seen years earlier.
Well, surely it wouldn't be at the front of your mind.
No, he just thought, yeah, they probably saw a baboon or whatever. But one morning he's having this meeting with the forestry department, one of the botanical scientists. And the scientist, his name's Johann, he had arranged to identify some of the plants that the elephants were eating. So he was getting, samples from their dung and whatever. And this scientist, he's going through the samples and, he's got his microscope and just kind of off the cuff, he just goes, "Oh, Gareth, while you're out there walking in the forests, have you ever come across a kind of furry, upright walking ape by any chance?" And the hotel manager's story just floods back into his mind. And he's like, "No, why are you asking me that?" And he says, "Oh, just in the past couple of years, we've had, a couple of separate reports from our forest workers of seeing a giant, hairy, upright walking ape in the forest." He said they were absolutely shocked at the sight. The men are adamant that it walks upright. It's covered in hair. "I'm just interested." That's all he said. "I'm interested to know what they're seeing."
Could it be like an unusual population of chimps? I know chimps normally aren't that far down, but there are facilities, like rescue facilities in South Africa. So.
You think people would recognize a chimp.
Yeah, you think.
Right?
Yeah.
So he thought this conversation was curious, and obviously, this is strange. This story's popped up again. He just decides to keep an open mind about it. But again, he's focused on his elephants. 5 months later, he's into his elephant research, engrossed in his work, and another account pops up. By this time, he was residing in the vicinity of the forest with his girlfriend, and they were fully into their research. And he passed this house on his way to the forest, and one of the neighbors was waving him over for a chat. And his name was Albury, and he asked how the elephant work was going. And kind of at the end of the conversation, he just slipped it in. He said, "Yeah, the forest is big and it hides a lot of elephants and other strange creatures, especially if you believe the story of my friends at the correctional services." He's so like, "What do you mean, other strange creatures?" So this guy's like, "Well, ape men I'm talking about." So he went on to tell Gareth that he had this colleague at work who had seen an ape man while he was in a Land Rover with his kid. He was with his brother and with his parents. And he basically said they were taking a ride on Sunday, as they always do. He was in the backseat with his older brother. He said they were rounding a hill and they just saw it, covered in hair, walking on two legs, walking away through the brush.
Was there a color?
Well, they said, no, they didn't mention a color, but that is mentioned later. But he said he turned to look at his brother just as if to say, "Did you see that?" And his brother's eyes were giant golf balls and his mouth was wide open. They were just speechless, absolutely in shock. And they didn't tell their parents at all. And he said, "I've lived my whole life and I certainly know what a baboon is, and that's no baboon. we still talk about it sometimes all these years later, just him and his brother. They didn't want to tell anyone because they didn't want to get ridiculed.
Yeah, of course.
So even when he asked two experienced forest guides that he's working with who are helping him track these elephants, they had stories too. Not their own stories, but from older family members, like an old, you know, uncle had seen one, or his grandfather had seen an upright gorilla in the forest. So it's starting to build that there's something to this, but still he hasn't seen anything himself. He's still focusing on his elephants. Now, at one point in his study, he comes across this quite mystical place. He says the elephants, they're obviously there. He still hasn't seen one yet, but they're obviously there. He's tracking them. He knows they're in the forest. And he starts following their tracks one day, and he notices that they go into this area that's inaccessible by vehicles because there's huge trees across the road. And he's convinced that the elephants are actually doing this on purpose. They know that vehicles come in and they try and block the roads. So he's following this kind of blocked off area. And eventually he comes to this kind of opening in the forest that he calls the secret place. Now he says it's this kind of spring, this beautiful spring. And as soon as he sees it, he knows that elephants must come from a long way to go here because there's all these signs of them drinking from this spring. And he took a sip from the water and immediately it was like, he says elephants are like water connoisseurs. Like they will actually travel, you know, like 100 kilometers just for a particular type of water. And he said as soon as he drank it, he knew the place was special because he just felt, it was like having 10 Gatorades at once. He just felt so pumped. Like having a coffee. He was just...
Oh, it's got a lot of high mineral content.
There was something about the water that just felt incredibly powerful.
Mm.
And as he's exploring this area, he ended up calling it the Elephant Cathedral because off to the side of this spring, there's all these rocks that are kind of jutting out of the forest floor, like huge rocks. And he said he went to stand on them. And again, there was some kind of... He's not very explicit about it, but you can read between the lines. He's saying there's some kind of energy to the place. There's some kind of spiritual power here. So he ends up calling it the secret place. So some weeks later, he had kept going back and forth. He still never seeing an elephant, but he would like stack up rocks for them. And then when he had come back to this place, the elephants had knocked the rocks down. Oh. And so then he had set up like a pile again. Then he'd come back a couple of days later and they had knocked it down. So it was kind of this communication.
There's a rapport happening.
So there's something going on. But then some weeks later, he's returning from this secret place in the forest. And he said, that's when I saw it. It was a clear sunny Sunday. He had trekked to the secret place. He had found that the elephants had been there. He said the sky was the brightest blue. The air was invigorating. He was feeling clear-headed. And he was just looking forward to getting back and taking his girlfriend out to lunch. He wasn't thinking about the elephants. In fact, he says, I don't think I was thinking about anything much at all. It was the perfect day. And then suddenly he gets this feeling that he's being watched. And he says, look, I've been roaming the wilds of Africa for years. And I've always been aware when someone or something is watching me. He says, whether it's a person or an animal, I can now detect it very succinctly. He says, I can sense somehow when hidden eyes are observing me. And he said, in the case of a hidden predator, what you actually do is the worst thing you can do is stop and try and look around to see what it is.
Why is that? Because it delays you?
It provokes aggression, apparently. It's seen as a threat. He says the best thing you can do is continue walking and just casually kind of scan around.
Makes sense.
Scan left and right. Stopping is what you don't want to do. So he does this. He feels that feeling. Something's definitely watching him. He keeps walking down the track and he's just casually looking left and right. And suddenly there, partially hidden behind a tree, he sees it peering at him. He says clearly it's a hominoid covered in russet hair. It's approximately 40 paces away and he's shocked. He's pretending not to see it. He says the only thing that stops him from running is the fact that he's been in the wilderness surrounded by wild animals for, you know, 30 years or something. So he carries on walking, just keeping it in the corner of his eye. And he continues walking for about a kilometer before he finally turns to look behind him and there's nothing, and he just sinks to the ground, utterly bewildered by what he's seen. He sat there on the ground, and it was strange because he said his mind felt like it had been enveloped in a kind of numbing fog, like a cloud on this beautiful day, like he's there was a storm around his head, and he just basically held his head in his hands and covered his eyes and sat there in shock.
It's quite telling because when we've covered reports before of people being allegedly attacked by Bigfoot-type creatures, they say that there's like an infrasound that's being emitted which causes them to become clouded and confused.
Yeah, so he never goes as far as suggesting something like that. But from all the eyewitnesses and the German tourists as well, you get a feeling that it's more than just, oh, I saw something weird. It's like a real...
There's something more to it.
Biological effect that's left behind on the eyewitness. And, you know, he was just numb, confused. He doesn't know how long he sat there on the ground, but gradually that fog lifted. And eventually he walked back to his vehicle and just started to think about what he had actually seen. So he said he sensed curiosity from this thing. He said that's something that's impossible to explain, but he also sensed that it was female and he sensed that it was benign. Like it wasn't hunting him or it didn't want to hurt him. It was just
this no threat.
Benign curiosity. It hadn't been overly fearful of him. And he thought that if he hadn't carried on walking though and he turned to face it, it would have basically ran away. So it was then that he wondered, how many times has this thing seen me before and I just haven't picked it up? Like how many times has it been watching me in the forest, trekking to and from this secret place of the elephants? So as he's walking, he starts to think about what it looked like. So clearly upright, covered in hair, russet in color, as we said. He hadn't really seen the face clearly, but it was the part of the head was covered in shadow. But he estimated about 5'3". So we're not talking 8 foot tall North American Sasquatch or anything. This is a 5'3" female leaning slightly to her right behind the tree. Just caught a glimpse of her and she appeared not to move, just basically curiously looking at him. So he eventually reaches the car. He drives home in a daze and just walks into his girlfriend and is like, oh, just completely in shock. Like he has a quote from her in the book and he's like, you were as white as a ghost. You were babbling. You were clearly something crazy had happened to you. So he discovered some of the older locals actually had more knowledge of this being. One of these people was this remarkable old lady, he said, who became a good friend of his. Her name was Mrs. Jordan. She lived in this little red house pretty close to where he was living. And it was from her that he learnt this creature's name. It's known as the Otung.
Otung?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Is there a meaning for it?
It probably just means ape man. Okay. I have no idea, just Otung. So he ended up in this conversation with her and usually they would talk about elephants and, you know, this thing never came up, but just in one of these conversations he had, because she would make him tea and they would sit and talk, she told him the most remarkable story. And this woman's 82 years old. She's got, you know, grown sons and daughters. She's been living here for decades.
So no nonsense as well.
Yeah. Really. And she said many years ago when her children were still small, so probably, you know, 60 years ago, she was living in a different part of the forest and an encounter took place. She said, they're like the elephants, Gareth. They like their solitude. They like their secretiveness. But a few of them are curious about us forest people. Like the one that I watched for about 15 minutes one night. And he's like, what? You saw one for 15 minutes? So this occurred, one night at her home. Her husband was away, which is a curious detail. And her children were all tucked into bed. Her children were sound asleep. And she's up knitting at the kitchen table. And all she's got is this little paraffin lamp, like no electricity. And she hears faint movements outside the kitchen door and her dog, Tammy, starts growling. And she looks over at the kitchen door and just for a slight moment, she sees the handle. Like she's not sure, but she swears she saw the handle moving on its own. Like something was on the other side trying to get in, trying to open it. And her first thought is, okay, which one of my kids is up? Like get back to bed.
Or is it an intruder?
Well, she steps across to a cabinet where she keeps a torch and she switches it on. She walks over to the kitchen sink and she looks out into the backyard where she's got a little vegetable garden. There's a big tree in the backyard. She shines the torch through the window to see if she can see anything, and there's nothing. She can't see a thing. So she goes back, sits down, keeps knitting. About half an hour later, she gets ready to go to bed. And again, her dog starts growling. And she looks closer and she sees that her dog, all the hair on the back of its neck is, like, all its hair is standing up on its back. So again, she reaches for a torch. She goes to the sink. She shines the light through the window. And standing there next to her vegetable patch, where she's growing sweet potatoes and spinach, is this broad-shouldered, muscular man. She's like, who's this huge bodybuilder in my backyard? And then she realizes, oh, crap, it's covered in dark hair. It's Otung. It's an Otung. So she starts trembling and she's watching it as this creature starts trying to shift out of the beam of light so it can kind of see who's behind it.
Yeah.
And this goes on for minutes. Like, it's not moving. It's just standing there.
It's a bit of a standoff.
Yeah. Like, she's standing there watching it for like at least 10 minutes. And suddenly she said the creature turned its head towards the nearby road as if listening. And in the blink of an eye, it was gone.
And as in, what, did it run?
She underlines that she had never seen anything move with such swiftness in her life. She says, not even, you know, tiny birds, you know, like sparrows who zip around. She says it was faster than that. There was something almost supernatural about how quickly it was gone.
So, but did she indicate that it actually ran, like she saw it move rapidly, or did it just disappear?
She says it vanished.
Hmm.
Okay. But he's saying it fled, but she's saying it vanished. So I'm not sure.
But we were just talking about this on the Plus episode, and it's quite abundantly clear. It's like that 3D and a half idea that they're slightly out of phase. They can go into another dimension. It's consistent with other reports we hear of the supernatural side of Sasquatch.
Yeah, it'd be good if obviously he's not aware of the other stories, because he probably would have asked that question.
This guy is doing research into proper zoological phenomena. I don't even think he'd even be possibly looking at the idea that they could be interdimensional.
Well, she goes inside quickly, locks the door, and a few minutes later she's in bed and she hears a truck drive past. So this thing, she had no idea this truck was coming. This thing's hearing was so acute that it heard the truck coming like 5 minutes before it arrived. And that's why it fled, or that's why it vanished. Now, the next morning, actually no, when the truck went past, she felt the need to just get up and have another look, because she thought maybe the truck's gone, it'll come back. So she goes and actually opens the door and goes outside. And she said it stunk. Like, it smelled like...
The stench of parrot. Was it sulfur or...
No. She said it smelled like a worked horse.
Oh.
So like a sweaty, pungent smell. But worse.
Yeah.
And then she stepped back inside, locked the door. Early in the next morning, she goes out and she sees the footprints. So she knows it wasn't a dream. She knows it was real. And she had told this story to him several times, and he had always assumed that the Otung that she saw would be the same height as the one that he saw, like around 5 foot something. So on one of these retellings of the story, and he said the details were always the same, he interjected and said, oh, so what you saw was about this height. And he kind of indicates by tapping his chest. And she's like, no, Gareth, why don't you listen to me? I've told you before, it was at least this high. And she holds her hand about a foot above his head or more. And he's like 6'2" or something. She says, it's this much taller than you. So now we're talking about over 7 feet tall. And now we're back in classical North American Sasquatch territory,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, we are, yes.
So there's an interesting perspective he has in this research when he's talking about the elephants and these creatures that he now knows is called the Otung. He said, I learnt long ago that one shouldn't actively search for Otungs or these nicer elephants. To do so, he said, seems to go against some natural law here. These beings will simply appear at an appropriate time. I have no idea what governs or determines this, but to seek them out is to be ultimately counterproductive to a lesser or greater degree. Understanding this was one of the reasons I decided to stop visiting the secret place of the elephants.
So is he suggesting there that the Bigfoot are somehow guardians of the elephants? Is that what he's saying?
There's something mystical.
Between the lines?
No, there's something mystical in what he's saying, though. Listen to this. He said, on each visit, a kind of guilt filled me. This is that secret kind of, not, well, he called it the secret place.
But like a mystical place.
That spring where the elephants went, that he drank the water and felt some power. He said, I felt as though betrayal was lurking close to me, like a shadow following me. And with each visit until the very last one, I felt increasingly as though I was pushing the boundaries of my endeavors. I knew that as long as I continued going to the secret place, the greater the chances were of experiencing these magical encounters, like with the elephants or perhaps even the otang. But he said, intuitively, I knew that something could also change or even snap. So I never returned. He said, I had listened with my heart and it was the right decision. And so this is, I guess, what you would call a kind of bushman's intuition. And there's some examples I'm going to have later on in this story where he uses this intuition, and other craftsmen of the forest use this intuition to somehow avoid tragedy. And that's, you're getting a sense that he's trying to avoid something that is like a disturbance. He doesn't want to disturb. There's something that he doesn't want to disturb. He doesn't want to break. But also, it's kind of like a jungle Wu Wei. It's this...
I don't want to use the term like a force, because it's not that, but it's like there's something in the ether. You can obviously feel it. Like some people might be attuned to it.
Well, there's something definitely metaphysical about this idea that you have to have a heart of non-action. You have to have a mind that's free of desires and attachments. It's almost like a Buddhist thing, right?
Mm.
If he's going out into the forest and desperately seeking this contact, he will never have the contact. It's like someone who's seeking out on a path of wisdom who desperately wants to develop the power to levitate or something. It's like you're never going to achieve it.
Yeah, it's unachievable.
It just becomes this attachment. It becomes this thing you'll never have. So it's almost like he understands this in this intuitive, weirdly spiritual way, that he has to just not attempt to find them and then he'll find them. And he has all these examples of where this seems to happen. So the very first time he actually saw one of these hidden elephants was a day where he's just like, you know what? Screw the elephants. Today I'm just going to take my dog for a walk.
Yeah, right. And so he's given up, and then it happens.
He just sees an elephant. Yeah. He's like, oh my God, what's going on? There's this young elephant right in front of him. It just walks out of the forest, like totally casual. It's almost like it's happy to see him.
But how often is it that that happens as well? Not just in this circumstance, but like you're working on something really hard or you're researching something. And you're like, you know, I give up. And you focus on something else and all of a sudden it comes to you.
That's why the Bigfoot guys never catch Bigfoot. Because they're out there like banging trees and
lighting
using
fireworks.
Calls and just all this. And yeah, they have activity. But the real contact stories, the really interesting contact stories, are when people are going out there and just they're going for a hike, or, you know, they're doing something completely different. The second example I'll give of this is someone ended up coming out. This company came out and did a documentary with him about these elephants, because it's such an incredible story that everyone thought there was one left and he ended up finding, you know, dozens and dozens of them secretly living in this forest. This company spent 2 weeks with him going into the forest every day. And of course, nothing. They don't find anything. No elephants, nothing. And they'd basically given up. They're like, okay, whatever, it's time to pack up. Yeah, sorry, this didn't work out. But in the very last hour, on the last day of their filming, this elephant just like strolls out of the forest right in front of them, like it's on a catwalk at a Paris fashion show. Like it just walks out there, kind of turns around, does a little strut, and they capture it all on film in the very last hour of them being there. And they had basically resigned themselves to the fact that we're never going to film this thing. It's time to pack up and go home. And it's almost like that state of mind.
That was the flag or the trigger that caused it to happen.
That state of mind allowed the magic to happen. So it's interesting that he has this magical kind of view of just nature in general. And there's a great story, you know, speaking of nature, super nature, there's a great story of Lyle Watson, because Lyle Watson, as we know, he was the author of
Supernature.
Supernature.
Yeah, he's incredible.
He wrote, a brilliant man. He wrote 24 books. Sadly, he passed away in, I think it was 2018. But an incredible guy. He was a botanist, a biologist, anthropologist. You know, we love his work. And the last book he wrote was called Elephantums. And it features these Gneissner elephants. And he actually had an experience when he was very young. In this forest, he saw one of these elephants. So because he had written this book and because he just had this connection to these elephants there, and he heard that there was only one matriarch left. He'd heard this, you know, official statement that they were functionally extinct. So he went out to the forest to investigate for himself, and he met Gareth. They became good friends, you know, exchanged letters, and he gave him a lot of his research before he died. But in the book Elephantums, Lyle Watson, before the end of the book, he talks about this encounter he had in the year 2000 with the matriarch.
Oh, he actually met it.
With that elephant, this old elephant, where this was the only one that the forest workers ever saw. And thus they assumed it was the only one in the forest. So,
but there was always something about Lyle Watson which was kind of supernatural. Even though he never really went down that, even though he obviously spoke about those sorts of topics, you could tell that he was never really fully a believer in that kind of stuff. He tried to rationalize it.
No, I think he was. He understood that science wasn't the be-all and end-all of knowledge. He understood that there was a mystical side to life. Mm. He wasn't a materialist by any means. But listen to this story. So one day he walked on the cliffs of the coastline where he'd seen his first Gneissner elephant as a child, one of these forest elephants. And that day when he was on the cliffs, he sat down on a rock, closed his eyes, and just basically meditated. Like, he listened to the white noise of the sea. And slowly when he opened his eyes, he saw a whale, because he's right on the coast. He's right on the edge of the rocks, and he sees this whale. And it's not a southern right whale that you would normally see in these waters. It's summertime, and he sees a whale that should not be there. It's the largest whale. It's a blue whale right out there in the ocean, like right off the shore. Now, Lyle Watson was also a whale expert. He really knew his whales. He was even the commissioner for whales in his hometown or wherever he's from. And he did a lot of like protection work for whales throughout his life. So the guy understood whales. He understood the biology. And that day, when he's on the cliff and he opens up his eyes, he sees this blue whale, which really shouldn't be there. He kind of gauges that it's a female. He gets a sense, or he can just tell, because he's a biologist, he can tell it's a female blue whale. And he just wonders, why is she here? She's way far away from where she usually would be at this time of year. And he's thinking about this, and he starts to feel this throbbing in the air, this kind of woo, 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 this like sub-bass frequency that he can't quite hear, but he can feel it.
Is it coming from the whale?
Well, he stands up and he's like, where is this sound coming from? And he looks down at this nearby gorge that leads down into the sea. So it's like this valley that leads out into the ocean. And he sees her. It's the matriarch. It's the elderly female elephant. He can see that she's got her broken off tusk. He knows this is the one that they're talking about. Now, elephants, they communicate with powerful infrasound. So it's below the limit of human hearing, and bioacoustics experts describe it as like a silent thunder almost. So it's like a vroom, vroom,
so you can
vroom.
Feel it.
You can feel it. Blue whales communicate with infrasound as well.
No, come on. The elephant's talking to the whale.
They're having a conversation. He's convinced the blue whale's like, hey, what's going on? And the elephant's like, it's lonely here. They're having some back and forth, like their neighbors talking over the fence. He says it's clear as day that they're obviously communicating.
I really shouldn't be surprised, because there is, you know, so much evidence out there that animals do communicate almost to the level that we do in some circumstances. Yeah. We don't understand it.
He says it was like matriarch to matriarch. And I thought that was just such a cool idea. It's such an awesome story. It's definitely worth mentioning. And there's a connection with Lyle Watson to where we live in Australia, because after he passed away, his ashes were scattered at Noosa Heads, which is where we live in Australia and Queensland. And his...
What an odd coincidence.
Yeah, I don't know what his connection to here was. Maybe he lived here in his later years, but...
I could actually see that point from my kitchen window.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible.
I was there last Sunday. And apparently the locals say that when they scattered the ashes, a pod of humpback whales appeared and surfaced multiple times where they had scattered the ashes.
Oh, that's incredible.
So there's all this kind of weird magical stuff surrounding his death as well. Now, there's a bunch of other encounters in here. There's a friend's son who sees one on a walking tour. And every case, it's like, it's kind of like that Soviet Sasquatch book that you were reading, I think, where it's just, I saw a hairy thing run off into the forest. There's like 20 of those encounters.
I saw a 7 or 8 foot tall hairy humanoid and it ran off.
There's a funny one with a forest worker who has a reputation for being super lazy. Like, his boss would always find him sleeping, or he'd be, you know, lying inside the scoop of the earth mover and having a nap. Like, he would, or he'd disappear for hours and no one would see him. He's very unreliable. And one day he was missing, and the boss goes looking for him, and he finds him like crouched down on the ground shaking. And he's like, "Why the hell aren't you at work? You've got all this stuff to do. Where the hell have you been?" He's like, boss, I saw the old tongue. I saw the ape man. The boss is like, bullshit, you saw the ape man, get back to work. He's like, boss, I swear. And he says at that moment, behind the boss, the ape man's like, like walks past the boss. And he's like, boss, turn around. Now the boss turns around and just catches it as it's disappearing into the forest. And so the other workers say that when they found them, because now the boss has gone missing, they found them crouched down near the earth mover, and they were just like shaking on the ground, and they had been there for 30 minutes.
Mm, okay, so these things are terrifying.
So again, that's the impact. There's like the psychological cloud that it seems to imbue on people. They were just shaking like little girls for 30 minutes. And then, of course, you've got this Nista Forest. It's incredibly large area, very popular tourist spot. But because it's so large and wild, you're going to have missing person cases.
Yeah.
And there's three cases that, in a weird way, are connected to the author, Gareth Patterson. And there's the mysterious disappearance of this 20-year-old university student, Rosalind Ballingall. This is probably the most famous missing persons case in South Africa's history. She disappeared on the 12th of August, 1969. There's the disappearance of a Green Bell Jet Ranger helicopter and its three occupants that was on the 6th of March, 1999. And there's the disappearance of this 13-year-old girl, Cetaline Mu, who vanished on the 8th of May, 2004. So let's talk a little bit about these, because there's some very strange details going on. So on March the 8th, 1999, this was 2 days after this helicopter just vanished, just completely disappeared. Gareth said he was giving a presentation in Johannesburg at the time, and it was an audience of business people, he said, and he centered his talk on the murder of his friend, George Adamson, the legendary lion man. He had rescued some of George's lion cub orphans. He kind of relocated them from Kenya to Botswana. He's telling this very moving story about his work with lions. And during the presentation, Gareth just drops in that he occasionally used a pendulum to locate missing lion cubs. I'm like, what? A pendulum? That came out of nowhere. So he says that he learnt this technique from this guy, the legendary lion man, George Adamson, who apparently told him one day how his brother Terence had discovered later in life that he had the ability to douse, and he used it successfully to locate George's lions and even missing people. So George recounted to Gareth how there was a visitor to his camp who told Terence that she had very sadly lost touch with her son in Australia. She had no idea where he was. You know, he was in his like late teens or early 20s, and she's just like, "I don't know where my son is. I really need to find him." So she asks this guy, Terence, "Please, can you help me find my son? Use your dowsing abilities." So he uses a pendulum and a map of Australia, right? Or a map of the state. And he said his pendulum started to go crazy over this remote Australian town in the middle of nowhere. And he basically said to her, I'm pretty sure your son's got something to do with this town, but I don't know what. Now, a year later, he heard back from this lady and she said, oh yeah, my son came home. Yes, he was in that town when you were doing your pendulum stuff.
And what, he just suddenly showed up or?
Yeah, he was just like, he just went walkabout. He was going through his angsty years and he's like, screw you, mom. And he went and stayed in some boonga bar somewhere in Queensland for months on end for God knows why.
And yet somehow he was able to pinpoint his location using a pendulum.
Yeah, he used a pendulum to find him. So eventually Gareth, the author of this book, was taught this technique. And he mentioned this in the presentation, just kind of dropped it as this, it's like a fun anecdote to put into the story. But after the presentation, this woman in the audience approached him and she was clearly upset. She, you know, her eyes were filled with tears and she was really upset. And she asked him, look, have you heard the story about the helicopter that's recently gone missing somewhere off the southern Cape coast? And he basically says, sorry, I haven't heard the story. You know, what happened? And she explained that the people flying in the helicopter that's gone missing were her friends. The pilot was Ian McFarlane, his wife Frances, and Ian's father Boyd. Now she asked Gareth if he could douse for the missing helicopter. And of course, there's this crying woman coming up to him. Of course, he's going to help.
Try, yeah.
So he's like, okay, I've never been there before, because at the time he had never been there. And he thought, okay, I'll try. So the next day he starts dousing for this missing helicopter. And he used a general map of the area because he didn't really know the Cape South Coast and he wasn't sure where the helicopter had gone missing. So he's got this very general map. And he says, look, if you want to locate something on a map, if it's a person or a living thing, the pendulum will swing clockwise. This is what he's discovered in his training. But as he began to search for them, he said the pendulum was ominously swinging anti-clockwise. And that indicates death.
Right.
Death has occurred. And he said it began to increase spinning in tighter circles on the map over a track named Petrus Brand Pad. It's just this track going through the forest. It's 2.5 kilometers south of the forest station near where he lives, or where he lives today. He didn't live at that time. Now, after he did this dousing, he said, look, I didn't contact the lady. I didn't let her know. I just, you know, forgot to get back to her. And he said he had actually heard the news later that day that aerial and ground searches were still ongoing. And he couldn't tell her that the pendulum indicated that her friends were dead.
Well, especially if you're wrong as well. I mean, you don't know. Yeah, it's no confirmation.
It was just too much. So he just kind of left it. And then 2 years later, with the commencement of the elephant study, the matter popped up again. He said the official search for the helicopter was incredible. Like, they had the South African Air Force looking for it. They had the Rescue Coordinating Center, the Southern Cape Regional Emergency Unit, the Mountain Club of South Africa, the Forestry Department staff, all these farmers, all the locals. They were just searching for weeks for this thing, and they found nothing. The family, the eldest son of the family, continued to search for a further 15 days after the official search stopped. They were using infrared equipment to scan the jungle. Nothing. This helicopter just vanished. These people had vanished. Now, the McFarlane family, in desperation, consulted a clairvoyant who stated that one of the family members had lived longer than the others, but now they were all dead. Now, he says in May 2001, on his very first research exploration into the Knysna Forest, he was nearing the end of his route on that particular day, and he was basically looking for signs for elephants. He's looking for dung, he's looking for, you know, brushes on the trees and all that sort of stuff. And he said suddenly he started to feel very, very ill, like very sick all of a sudden, like something was wrong. And he couldn't understand why he was feeling that way, just this gut feeling. Again, that it's like that Bushman's intuition, like something is desperately wrong. And he stops for a moment and then he looks at the map and he's like, what track am I on? And it's Petrus Brand Pad. It's the place where the pendulum had indicated 2 years earlier where this helicopter had crashed.
See, I mean, this, from a skeptical standpoint, you could probably assume, though, that that's what came up and it was such a emotionally jarring thing, and he had a crisis of consciousness about it. So it put that name into his head. So maybe subconsciously he kind of knew where he was, and that's what caused him to have that feeling.
I guess he could argue that. It's 2 years later though, so I don't see why it would be on his mind.
Well, that's the other side of the coin, is that it probably wasn't on his mind, and yet he goes to that location and it just somehow intuitively he knows where he is.
Well, anyway, when he's back at home, he tells his girlfriend about this strange feeling that came over him while he was on this Petrus brand pad track. And he had mentioned it to no one else in the months and years that followed. Now, 5 years later, on the 21st of April 2006, a harvesting team is preparing to cut lines just off this track, off this Petrus brand pad. And amongst them is a guy named Johnny Delamini. Now, in front of him, just meters away, he sees this helicopter.
Oh.
And it's exactly where Gareth's pendulum had been spinning five, 6 years earlier.
And unfortunately, were there decaying bodies in it?
Well, he sees, it's like a movie, like he sees the forest green wreckage of the helicopter. At first, he's like, what is this thing? He gets closer and he sees that there's still two people strapped into the seats.
Yeah.
And he immediately turns around to run. And just like in like a creepy movie, he trips over the corpse of the third body on the ground.
Oh, so the clairvoyant was correct.
Yeah. Now, Gareth says his forestry friend, Cyril Sam, was the second person on the scene of the crash site. And he told Gareth that the harvesting team had come across recent signs of elephants in the vicinity of the crash site. So what was weird about the search is the search party had gone through this area countless times. It is a little bit like missing 411. They had just gone through this area.
People didn't find anything.
People in the following 6 years constantly went past this area. Like, it was quite a busy track because it's right next to a plantation. They're doing works there. And it was just bizarre that no one had ever found this helicopter. It was just right there for so many years.
Right. And for people that don't know, with the missing 411 cases, one of the surreal elements of it is that you'll find a body will show up, but a body will show up on a track that has been searched multiple times.
What actually happened? The elephants covered it up.
What?
The elephants covered it up. It's a cover up. the elephants did it.
Well, they covered up the helicopter.
The elephants did 9/11. Like... The elephants covered up this helicopter crash. let me explain. So he's been in touch with elephant behavior experts for years, obviously, with his research. And there's one named Joyce Poole who answered his question years ago when he heard about this helicopter crash. She confirmed that elephants scatter earth and branches over their own dead, but they also, they cover up the dead of other species. So there's even reports of elephants who have
so hard to find chimps in the wild for so long.
Maybe that's got something to do with it. Like there's a story of an elephant finding a dead pig and basically giving it a burial. Like, they cover it with dirt, they cover it with leaves and branches.
Aren't they thoughtful creatures?
If they kill a human being, they will also cover up the evidence. They will basically, like if they squash some Indian dude, they'll get dirt and they'll cover up the body and put branches all over it. So this is what happened with the helicopter. There was all this evidence of elephant activity.
These elephants are like, did we kill them? Did we cause that? Well, we better cover it up. Okay,
so
cover it up.
They basically recognize a dead sentient being and they try and give it a kind of burial, which is an amazing behavior.
Of course it is, yeah. But here I am thinking they just didn't like the helicopter on their land. So like, well, we need to cover that up.
Yeah, they threw a coconut at it and knocked it out of the sky. And they were like, yeah, that's right. Just buried it up. It's like the mafia, like digging a grave for Jimmy Hoffa or whatever. So... yeah, that's what would happen. That they'd hidden this helicopter, so whenever people were going past, they just never saw it. It was so well camouflaged. So let's move on to the next mysterious disappearance. This is the really famous one. This is Rosalind Ballinger. It occurred 30 years before this helicopter went missing. She was a 20-year-old, tall, very attractive, well-liked student at the University of Cape Town. She was studying drama, and she came from a really well-to-do, wealthy Johannesburg family. The father was an executive of one of the mining companies in the country. And her disappearance, again, very famous because it's from a rich, prominent family in Johannesburg. But also the time period in South Africa, it was a time with apartheid was really strong, but also the hippie era was kind of coming through. So young people, university students were basically defying the apartheid system, but also defying their parents' values. So it's an interesting time in history, and she went missing. It was just this huge story.
Well, if there's social upheaval as well, I mean, you know, did she go missing as a result of that, or was it the...
Well, it's a very suspicious... I don't want to spend too much time on it, because you can probably, you know, listen to
multiple ways.
An entire podcast series about the murder or her disappearance. So her fellow students described her as depressed and suffering from anxiety. There's also reports she was a drug user, but... The story goes she was invited by two acquaintances, not friends. There was a guy named Sasya Sergeyev and his companion, Tanya Geffen, invited her to join them for a break at a cottage known as the Sugar House.
Not a good start.
What do you think the sugar's referring to?
Is it heroin? Or
I don't know. Some kind of drug. Some kind of drug house in the forest. So according to police reports, she was last seen leaving this house the morning after her arrival. Apparently going for a walk in the forest. Some reports said she was carrying a Bible and she was looking for the closest church.
Oh, come on.
No, apparently that's part of the story. Others said that after she was leaving the house, she stopped to talk to some owner of another house who had given a chocolate the day before. This. Multiple no one knows angles. What happened to her, basically. Long story short, some people say she was attacked and killed by wild animals. There's stories about witchcraft. There's stories about alien abduction. Some speculated that she faked her death and took on a new identity. And the day after she went missing, though, obviously there's a huge search. So it's like the helicopter, like the Air Force is called in because she's from a rich family as well. It's like all the strings are pulled and it's this massive, massive search. And it really is like missing 411. There's no evidence at all. She has just completely vanished. Like, there's nothing at all. Eventually, on the 26th of August, they're like, case closed. Like, there's just no evidence. Now, her parents obviously didn't give up hope. So they hired private investigators, private search parties. They enlisted the assistance of a Colonel Ford, the former Northern Rhodesia policeman. And also in desperation, they consulted clairvoyants. Now, one of the clairvoyants they hired, because they hired people from all around the world, was this Belgian psychic, apparently very well regarded. And he actually used a pendulum as well. So he used pendulums and maps. And he made this prediction that Rosalind's body was in this deep ravine near the junction of two forest roads. And it was less than 3 kilometers from this sugar house where they were staying. Now, at the time, this is way back in 1969, 1970, the former East African game warden, this guy named Nick Carter, he had been commissioned by the South African Wildlife Society to do a study of the elephants in the area, because this was back before, you know, they were functionally extinct. There was still a population there. So he was doing a study. And this family, this rich Johannesburg family, they get this location from the psychic in Belgium. They're basically convinced, okay, we've got to look in this ravine. This is where he's saying her body is. So it just so happens that this game warden is in that area at the time. So they get in contact with him and they beg him to investigate this ravine. You've got to go, please, please help us. You've got to go have a look down there. So of course he agrees. So he goes out one day, he goes to the exact spot that this Belgian psychic said, this is where the body is. And he reaches this a rim of the ravine and he suddenly feels incredibly ill. Like it's almost like he's walking into a weird force field of sickness and he doesn't understand it. But again, he's a wise man of the bush and he listens to his intuition. And immediately he knows, I'm not going down there. There's no way I'm going down there because it's this deep, dark ravine and everything, every cell in his body is just going, no, get the hell out of there. It's very strange. And he says he's only experienced this like a handful of times in his entire life. And he's a game warden. So he's like, his entire life is in the forest surrounded by animals. Now, the father of this missing girl died in 1980. The mother died in 1984. And again, Rosalind went missing in 1969. And to this day, it's completely unsolved. Now, fast forward to 2004. This is 35 years after this poor girl's disappearance. And Gareth one morning receives an email from this woman named Nicole Schaefer. And she's doing a master's degree in film and television at the University of Cape Town. And she wants to do a documentary on this missing woman. It's called The Ballad of Rosalind Ballinger. And she asks him if she can interview him for the documentary because the elephants are part of the story. Like maybe there's a theory that she was killed by an elephant. Maybe she was, you know, crushed to death, or, you know, knocked out by a trunk and the elephants buried her.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like
that's a possibility.
It's a reasonable possibility. So he agrees to be interviewed. And during the next year, he actually went into the forest several times with her for the filming of this. And they usually had deep discussions about Rosalind and the case. They got to know each other quite well. They became friends. And towards the end of the filming sessions in the forest, she knew that he also knew how to use the pendulum for dowsing. Right. So she actually asked him, you know, could you do a pendulum search for Rosalind's body? So he thinks about it and he's like, look, I'll do it, but I'm not comfortable with you filming it. It just, you know, it just feels wrong. Feels kind of a bit off to do it in front of the camera. So I'll do it, but let's do it off camera. So she agrees. And he uses this black and white image of Rosalind and a map of the forest. And he covers the forest with newspaper. So he's not like biasing himself. So he can't actually see what the map is doing. And he starts dowsing. Now, he eventually finds a location, like the, you know, the thing's spinning counterclockwise and it hones in on this area. And he tells this filmmaker, Nicole, he's like, I think I've found a location. She's like, great. Can you take me out there? So a few weeks later, he's like, okay, let's go. So they drive out there, or they hike out there, sorry, and they start approaching this vicinity where the pendulum had gone crazy on the map. And they set out on foot, get to the spot, and he gets to this ravine. And it's, now he doesn't know the story of the Belgian guy, and neither does she, right? They don't know that story. But he gets to the edge of this ravine, and all of a sudden he's like, we're not going down there. He feels that same feeling, that horrible gut knowing that something is off, something is wrong, turn, run, get the hell out of there now. You're going to die, you're going to die, you're
going to
die.
Don't you have to wonder what's going on with this though? What's it doing that it's causing this response? Are some people sensitive to it? Is it going to cause it to every single person that comes here?
What's down there?
What's down there?
What's in that ravine? Maybe her body, maybe her body and something else. So he turns to her and he just says, we're not going down there. We're not going any further, Nicole. He says, look, sorry. I have such a bad feeling right now. We're going back to the car. Like, no, this isn't a conversation. We're going back right now.
Good call.
Now, see, she can see the seriousness in his face and his voice. And she says, okay, let's go back. Now, weeks later, during her research of the film, Nicole uncovers the story of this Belgian psychic.
Oh,
and then realizes it's the exact same ravine. It's the exact same location. Both of them had nailed it. And both he and this game warden from 1979 or whenever it was, had this gut feeling of get the hell out of there. So what is down there?
Well, would they go back with, you know, authorities, people with guns, hunters, a larger group?
Nope.
Why not?
Because no one's going back. It's too dangerous. No one in their right mind is going back there.
Well, you go back with a posse.
Why don't you go out there? Let's do a GoFundMe for Aaron Wright to go into the South African jungle.
If I got a bunch of hardcore people with guns with me, we're going.
Have you not seen the documentary Predator starring Arnold Schwarzenegger? Have you not seen that documentary? Do you have any concept of what's going to happen to you in the jungle?
I'm thinking more of Jurassic Park, and I'd be like halfway down there, I'd be like, clever girl, and I'm done. I'm gone.
Yes.
Eaten by a raptor.
You will be violated by one of these ape men down there. I can just spell it out for you. This is what's going to happen. And then I'll be pendulating for your body live on the show.
Spinning the dead way. Well, he dead.
Yeah. Is there like a direction for rape? That spins.
Terrible bed. Absolutely terrible.
Is there like a direction for being violated by an ape man? Is this some kind of pendulum code for that? So the third one, the third missing person case was Celine Moo. Her last name's M-O-O-S. I don't know if it's Moose or Moose. I'm just going to say Moo. I'm going to drop the S. So this was a really sad one. This is a 13-year-old girl. She went missing in the Knysna Forest on Saturday, the 8th of May, back in 2004. And he says, look, if you Google this one, there's not much information at all because it's not, like, it's no less poignant, no less tragic and mysterious as the other famous girl, but it's just not as well known. So this young girl, since the age of 2, she'd lived with her grandmother in a village just 10 kilometers from the picnic site where she went missing in the forest. And she was attending the birthday party of a 14-year-old girl, Eugene Mowers, whose family owned a local taxi business. And there's speculation that when she got to the party, some of them were drinking alcohol in the afternoon. There's the eyewitnesses said that she helped one of her friends to the nearby shallow stream and her friend fell in. So she kind of had to fish her friend out and her clothes got all wet. This is the official story. And she ended up going to the public toilets to wring out her clothes because they were all wet. And that's the last time she was ever seen. She was wearing a black and white Billabong shirt, black jeans, white flip-flops. Never seen again.
No trace at all.
No trace. So like before, huge search, police, firemen, local farmers, helicopters, sniffer dogs, the whole thing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Weeks. The only thing they found was a slice of bread near the entrance to the toilets and a few footprints several kilometers north of Jubilee Creek where the party was.
Unfortunately, that could be anything.
And that's what police said. Police said at the time, neither the slice of bread nor the footprints could actually be linked to the scene of her disappearance. So months later, though, after she went missing, Gareth says he was at this picnic site one morning and just by chance came across the veteran forest guard, the friend of his, Letty Sam. And they sat down, they had a chat on the wooden benches and, you know, talking about the elephants. But then obviously the disappearance of this young girl, this tragedy came up. And this man, Letty, confirmed what the policeman had told Gareth, that there had been elephant activity near the creek at the time.
So the elephant had accidentally trampled her and then buried her?
Yeah, so this forest guy, he had actually seen an elephant right at that picnic spot a few days before this young girl went missing.
Sounds like a lot of elephant scapegoating.
So yeah, this is the thing, like, and this is what he eventually told the police. Like, maybe he actually told the police the elephant behavior. He said, did you look for signs of a burial? Because it's possible an elephant might have killed the girl and then buried her somewhere, you know, covered her in dirt and really buried her. And the police, by the time the police had that information, they'd already officially called off the search.
Sure. Okay.
So they didn't do any more searching. But there was something curious that this forest guy told Gareth in addition to this. He said when the search was called off, the police reported a few footprints had been found on a track near Jubilee Creek, like near this picnic spot. But again, they couldn't be linked to the disappearance. But this forest guy, Liddy, he told Gareth that during the week of the search, he had gone to check on those footprints himself and he'd actually started to follow them. And he followed them for a while, but then he realized there was a second set of footprints that had joined the first pair on this track. And they were strange footprints, shoeless footprints that looked humanoid. Slightly human, but weren't quite human. Now, shocked, he stopped tracking. Like, he turned around, he headed back towards the Jubilee Creek picnic site. Cause again, he's an experienced forest guy and he's like, I'm not going to mess with these.
Yeah.
Whatever this is. But he confided in Gareth when they were at that picnic spot. He's like, I think that she was taken by an otang. I think that's what happened because of those footprints. So there's some crazy stories in here. And he actually ends up having 3 sightings. He sees another otang that's 5.5 feet high, dark brown hair. And this one is like a juvenile who seems to wait at the last minute for him to see it. And then it like vanishes.
Playing games, yeah.
And same thing, he says the speed is paranormal. It's the speed that they move is just, your mind can't comprehend it. It's like watching special effects in a movie or something. He says it's so quick.
It's gone.
But he also said it had a bodybuilder's physique, like huge shoulders, very, very muscular. He was sure it was male. Didn't get a good look at the face. And then later on, he and his girlfriend, they start finding child's footprints on some of the tracks in the forest.
What, suggesting that she wasn't dead, that she'd somehow...
No, this isn't related to the missing girl. They look like children's footprints, but everything about it says that it's not a child,
right?
Because it's a pair of footprints that's on its own. And based on the size of the print, it would be like a four-year-old. But they're in the middle of this forest, like a kilometers into the forest, and they're prints by themselves. And he sees them a couple of times. And he's like, what is going on? This is too bizarre. And then a few weeks later, after he starts finding these, he came across this German couple who have lived in the area for years, and they're out walking their dogs. And they stop and like chat with him because they know him. And they say, oh, you know, Gareth, have you seen these bare human footprints around? And this woman's, you know, glancing at her husband and saying, from time to time, we come across these strange, bare, human-like footprints, and some are very small, like those of children. So this couple is seeing them as well on this track. So it's like, well, what is actually going on out there? Now, he's also with a friend one night, and suddenly his friend like nearly slams on the brakes and nearly drives off the road. And he's like, what the hell happened? Because he wasn't really looking at the road. And she's like, I saw a giant, hairy, muscular beast run across the road. And it's like, it's got beige hair and it's huge and it's like crazy fast movement.
So in this day and age, you know, if you're coming from a modern society, you know what most wildlife looks like. So the idea that what I suggested before, like, could these be chimps, is obviously not the case. Like, they're not chimps. And the fact that so many different people are seeing and reporting the same thing suggests that there is actually something there.
Well, he has three direct eyewitness sightings. And the third eyewitness sighting, he's checking one of his trail cameras because something is like ripping them off the trees, and he's convinced it's baboons, but then they're too strong for baboons. And he hears this crash of vegetation, and he looks up and he sees a large, tall otung fleeing, and it seems like it's in utter panic. But he notices that it's over 7 feet tall. And it's, again, it's the beige colored hair. So it's exactly the same color,
same species,
that his friend had seen just a few weeks earlier. So there's some incredible sightings in there. It's a really fascinating story. And it's just, again, you're adding to the list of these hominids that seem to be existing out in the wilderness of our world that remain undetected.
Yeah, they remain elusive.
And the mystical side of it is, yeah, what's down in that ravine? Why are people getting these horrible gut feelings? Like, what is actually happening?
Yeah, because it's like an innate response to something which is just naturally bad. Like,
or
obviously.
Or is that where they live and they're just sending out some kind of infrasound, some kind of message?
Well, that's another possibility.
That makes humans freak out.
Mm.
You know, maybe they, maybe that girl went and lived with them for a bunch of years.
Yeah, well, perhaps, I mean, who knows how it works from, you know, a physiology kind of point of view, but perhaps like children, maybe children can't, you know, be affected by it until a certain age. You know, it's like your hearing changes as you grow older, you know, and you can hear certain sounds, certain frequencies when you're younger, and that changes. Maybe it's the same kind of thing, but on an infrasound level.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many questions, but there's obviously there's something happening. There's something going on out there. And the whole thing with the elephants, again, just underlines you can have these giant creatures out there.
Yeah.
And the official word up until 2019, even when he released his book and said, no, I've got all this evidence, I've got DNA evidence.
No.
Yeah, they were like, no, there is only one elephant. That's South African accent, by the way. And he did all this DNA evidence where he pulled out what they were eating from their dung. No, not what they're eating. He basically pulled DNA out of their dung and proved there was, I think, 6 females and 2 bulls.
Oh, so right. So he was able to actually get DNA profiles.
Yeah, he published a study co-authored
what
with
the
this
hell?
Geneticist, and still the park was like, no, there's only one.
Oh, just the level of, it must be laziness. That must be what it is.
Yeah, and there's all this interesting stuff in there. Definitely, I'll recommend picking up this book because he also discovers that they eat mushrooms, these elephants, and they're the only
hallucinogenic mushrooms.
They're the only, no, not hallucinogenic, but they're the only elephants in the world that eat this kind of fungus. And he contacted elephant experts across the entire world, like, you know, India and Thailand and across Asia. And they're like, no, there's no record of elephants eating mushrooms. Like, I look at their poop every day. They don't eat mushrooms. And every time he looks at their samples, they're eating this weird mushroom that grows like on the side of logs. And so he looks it up and it's a traditional medicine.
Oh.
It's like a medicine. He says the actual compounds is what AIDS patients take.
Oh.
Because it's so...
Is that anti-parasitic?
Yeah, there's something about it that's really... I can't remember what it was.
There's, what animals? There are other animals that consume anti-parasitics because obviously parasites are, you know, a big issue for animals that can't go and seek medical treatment. It's also like the macaws, they consume this red earth.
Yeah.
And because the earth allows them to consume poisonous berries. Like, it's amazing. Like, these animals are just so intelligent and so just, it's well, incredible.
The other thing he found in their diet was an alien tree. He found an Australian tree that was brought in like 60 years or earlier and introduced to South Africa. It's not a native tree. And they eat the bark of it. And he's like, why do they keep eating this Australian bark? Like, it's 60% of their diet is eating the bark of this Australian tree.
Is it nutritious or something?
It's like a protein shake. It's like 60% protein. So they're eating this.
Highly, highly adapted to their environment. And this is how they're surviving.
Yeah, incredible story. I'll link to the book in the show notes. That's Beyond the Secret Elephants from Gareth Patterson. And Secret Elephants is his first book. I'll link to that as well. That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. Huge stuff coming up, though. Aaron's got a killer story. I can't wait to hear it. We've got weird yoga poses.
Well, they're not so much yoga. They're ancient. They're on, you know, French cave wall depictions of postures, but those postures are essentially keys to open on different doors to different realities, all done through trance.
So weird.
So if
interpretive dance moves that send you into other dimensions.
Yes. If you get your legs so far behind your head, I'm sorry, that you look like Nicki Minaj in one of her music videos, that is how you can access a certain realm.
Maybe that's where Nicki Minaj comes from. Another realm. Another dark realm.
All will be revealed, Ben. All will be revealed.
That's coming up after this. To get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. You get big extensions on the end of these shows every single Friday. Plus members also get entirely exclusive shows on Tuesdays. You're getting more than double the content when you sign up for Plus. You also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalog as well. Plus members also get a higher quality MP3 version of the show, so you're getting the best audio we put out. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free MU. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Plus extension, great to have you with us.